It's July 2nd, 1816. The French frigate Medusa is on voyage from France to the colony of Senegal. On board are sailors, soldiers, and passengers, including Charlotte Picard, who is traveling with her father, infantry captain Charles Picard. She has been keeping a detailed journal of her voyage. She writes, "At noon, on the 2nd of July, soundings were taken. Monsieur Madet, ensign of the watch, was convinced we were upon the edge of the Arguin Bank. The captain said to him, as well as to everyone, that there was no cause of alarm. In the meanwhile, the wind blowing with great violence impelled us nearer and nearer to the danger which menaced us. A species of stupor overpowered all our spirits, and every one preserved a mournful silence, as if they were persuaded we would soon touch the bank. The color of the water entirely changed, a circumstance even remarked by the ladies. About 3 in the afternoon, a universal cry was heard upon deck. All declared they saw sand rolling among the ripple of the sea. The captain, in an instant, ordered to sound. The line gave 18 fathoms, but on a second sounding, it only gave 6. He at last saw his error and hesitated no longer on changing the route, but it was too late. A strong concussion told us the frigate had struck. Terror and consternation were instantly depicted on every face. The crew stood motionless, the passengers in utter despair. In the midst of this general panic, cries of vengeance were heard against the principal author of our misfortunes, wishing to throw him overboard. But some generous persons interposed and endeavored to calm their spirits by diverting their attention to the means of our safety. The confusion was already so great that Monsieur Poinsignon, commandant of a troop, struck my sister Caroline a severe blow, doubtless thinking it was one of his soldiers. At this crisis, my father was buried in profound sleep, but he quickly awoke, the cries and tumult upon deck having informed him of our misfortunes. He poured out 1,000 reproaches on those whose ignorance and boasting had been so disastrous to us. However, they set about the means of averting our danger. The officers, with an altered voice, issued their orders, expecting every moment to see the ship go in pieces. They strove to lighten her, but the sea was very rough and the current strong. Much time was lost in doing nothing. They only pursued half measures, and all of them, unfortunately, failed. The Raft of the Medusa, today, on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventure. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. Thank you so much for listening. Maritime history is filled with tragic stories of human suffering, and I've discussed many of those stories on this podcast already. The wreck of the Medusa is one of the most disturbing among them and contains descriptions of great violence, murder, and cannibalism. Much of this content will appear in Part 2. While I will not be overly graphic in the details, listener discretion is advised. Much of the information gathered for this episode comes from a contemporary account by survivors of the wreck of the Medusa. Ship surgeon Jean-Baptiste Henri Savigny and engineer Alexandre Corriard published their shocking account titled Narrative of a Voyage to Senegal. Charlotte Picard published her account in 1824 entitled The Sufferings of the Picard Family After the Shipwreck of the Medusa in the Year 1816. In order to understand the mission of the Medusa and the internal conflicts going on among its occupants, we'll start with a bit of historical background. Starting in the year 1109, the English and French were engaged in war with each other for the better part of 900 years. On and off, and for a variety of reasons, the two empires fought each other on land and at sea. As a result, the respective armies and navies grew stronger and more formidable as they clashed, along with Spain, to become the dominant force in Europe and the world. The Age of Discovery opened up the Americas, Africa, and Asia to colonial ambitions, and European spheres of influence quickly expanded. By 1626, French interests in Western Africa began in Senegal. By 1659, the primary settlement of Saint-Louis was established at the mouth of the Senegal River. French desire to control this area was due to two primary economic factors. First was acacia gum, also known as gum arabic, an extract produced from the sap of acacia trees. The variety of acacia in Western Africa called Acacia Senegal produces a particularly high-quality gum arabic and was highly sought after for use in textile production. France had essentially removed the Dutch from the area and took over the gum arabic trade. In addition, the French wished to profit from the enslavement of humans. In 1677, France acquired the island of Gorée, and it became a key trading port for slaves. The coastal area of modern-day Senegal had traded hands between the Portuguese, English, Dutch, and French as wars and political conflicts continued for over the next 100 years. During the French Revolution, which began in 1789, the nobility and the aristocracy of the Ancien Régime, or Old Order, largely remained loyal to the Bourbon monarchy. To escape the terror of the bloody revolution led by Maximilien Robespierre, these anti-revolutionary nobles, called émigrés, sought exile in other lands, with some actively plotting against the revolution. The revolution resulted in the creation of the First French Republic, which gave way to the First French Empire under Napoleon Bonaparte in 1804. When Napoleon was defeated and exiled to the island of Elba in 1814, the Bourbon monarchy under King Louis XVIII was restored. But Napoleon escaped, aided by his loyal soldiers, and landed in the south of France in 1815. During the now famous 100 days, Napoleon again took control of France, albeit briefly. European powers sympathetic to the monarchy, called the Seventh Coalition, defeated Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815. Napoleon was again exiled, this time to the remote South Atlantic island of St. Helena, where he remained until his death in 1821. With Napoleon permanently out of the way, King Louis XVIII was reinstalled as King of France, and the émigrés were welcomed back by the king. In return for their loyalty, Louis gave control of the military to his faithful nobles, appointing them as naval and army officers, regardless of skill or experience. Former revolutionaries and Republican supporters of Napoleon had no love for the Bourbon monarchy or its loyalists. From the fallout of Napoleon's defeat, the Congress of Vienna was convened to determine what the post-Napoleonic world would look like. As part of the Treaty of Paris, it was mandated for Senegal to be returned to France, and King Louis ordered a small convoy of ships to travel from France to the settlement of Saint-Louis to take over, this time peacefully, from Great Britain. To command this convoy, King Louis appointed Viscount Hugues Douat de Chaumareix, a reward for his loyalty following the Bourbon Restoration. Chaumareix was, in fact, a naval officer prior to fleeing France in 1790, having served in the American War of Independence to some acclaim. But Chaumareix had not sailed in 20 years, and he was essentially retired. Many other deserving officers were passed up for command of the convoy, which caused much resentment. The sailors simply did not trust the experience or skills of Chaumareix, and making matters worse, many of the other officers on the expedition were either Republicans who supported Napoleon or anti-monarchist revolutionaries. They viewed Chaumareix as nothing more than a useless political appointee and a crony of the Bourbon King Louis XVIII. Despite their lack of enthusiasm, they all understood the punishment for disobeying orders was death. The convoy under the command of Chaumareix consisted of cargo vessel La Loire, the brig Argus, the corvette Echo, and Chaumareix's frigate La Meduse, or the Medusa. The Medusa was an impressive frigate of 180 tons, 47 meters in length, and carried 44 guns. However, for this voyage, she was stripped down to just 14 guns to make room for passengers and cargo. The Medusa had previously seen action during the Napoleonic Wars, and earned the reputation as a very fast and agile ship, often outrunning its British counterparts. The voyage got underway from the west coast of France at the Ile d'Aix on the 16th of June, 1816. Sailing south in light winds, and sometimes no wind at all, progress was slow. As the convoy passed Cape Finisterre in northwest Spain, the smaller and slower Loire and Argus were forced to break off, being unable to keep up. The Echo remained in sight of the Medusa, but just barely. The convoy's first destination was the archipelago of Madeira, where they planned to rest and resupply. As this was largely a diplomatic mission, the passenger list included many dignitaries, including the new governor of Senegal, Colonel Julien Désiré Schmaltz, and his wife. The Medusa carried 400 people, including 160 sailors and naval officers, a battalion of soldiers and army officers to be stationed in Saint-Louis, mercenaries from Italy, Spain, the Americas, and elsewhere, tradesmen, officer servants, a contingent of engineers and scientists from the Philanthropic Society, and a smattering of passengers. During this portion of the journey, the first of many unfortunate events took place, when a 15-year-old sailor fell through the gunport of the ship. He was almost saved when a boatswain's mate grabbed him by the jacket, but he could not hold on, and the boy fell into the sea. Cries of "man overboard" rang out, but many of the crew were distracted, watching a playful school of porpoises. The young sailor managed to grab hold of a dangling rope from the ship, and he held on for dear life. But being dragged behind the Medusa at great speed, was unable to hang onto the rope, and the Medusa sped away from him. In a desperate attempt, several of the crew tied ropes around themselves and went into the ocean to retrieve the boy, but could not reach him. Finally, a life buoy was thrown into the sea in hopes the boy could swim to it. It was only then that Captain Chamaret ordered the ship to heave to and sails to be trimmed. A small skiff with three sailors was sent after the boy, but after a lengthy search and heavy seas, they were forced to return to the Medusa. The Medusa fired a signal cannon, signaling man overboard to the Echo, hoping its crew could save the boy. After searching for some length, the ships had no choice but to continue on, leaving the boy to his fate. In their account, Henri Sévigné and Alexandre Coriard criticized the slow response by Chamaret, writing, "The maneuver was long, and we should have come to the wind as soon as they cried man overboard." The Medusa once again sped away from the Echo, and Captain Chamaret expected to see Madeira on the morning of the 26th of June. But morning came and went, as did the afternoon. Finally, later that day, Madeira was spotted around sunset. At some point early in the voyage, Chamaret made acquaintance with a passenger and member of the Philanthropic Society, Antoine Richefort. This man was a self-proclaimed expert navigator, but more importantly to Chamaret, he was a monarchist. Richefort was in fact a charlatan, a boastful con man seeking power, prestige, and favor among the monarchists. Chamaret placed his complete trust in Richefort, making him the ship's pilot, and ordered all aboard to obey his orders. Navigation errors caused the Medusa to be a whole degree off course, meaning it was 60 nautical miles from its intended position. Chamaret dismissed the error, claiming the currents from the Strait of Gibraltar pushed the ship off course. That night, the Medusa tacked back and forth, approaching the island and then veering away, and by morning the ship was sailing south past the town of Porto do Sol on Madeira's south coast toward Funchal. The junior officers pleaded with Chamaret to put more distance between them and the shore, fearing running aground in utter disaster. Chamaret and Richefort wasted much time, taking the ship too close to shore and then maneuvering back out again. For what purpose, nobody knew. Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. As the ship continued on, drawing closer and closer to land, they were in lee of Madeira and lost their wind. Without wind, the ship was at the mercy of the currents, which threatened to push the Medusa on shore. Lieutenants Jean-Baptiste Espiot and Joseph Reynaud had some heated words with Chaumaret regarding the safety of the ship, and finally, the captain consented to seeking deeper waters. Gaining new wind and sailing at 8 knots, Chaumaret decided against stopping at Madeira for supplies, and instead would proceed for their next stop at Tenerife. Those on board watched wistfully as the lush and exotic island of Madeira faded into the distance. By the morning of the 29th of June, the Medusa sailed into the misty bay of Santa Cruz at Tenerife. Lieutenant Reynaud, Ensign Lafreyere, and midshipman Sander Rang led a party to go ashore to the settlement of St. Croix, but they languished for hours in the scorching sun as the necessary arrangements were made to receive them. The men could hear the bells tolling incessantly on the island as residents of Tenerife celebrated the Feast of St. Peter. At long last, the party was brought on shore and introduced to Governor Don Pedro de Rodriguez. After exchanging pleasantries, the men went about their business of acquiring fresh supplies for the remaining journey. The men were tempted by the invitations of Tenerife's young ladies to stay ashore longer, but ultimately returned to the Medusa by late afternoon. Governor Schmaltz wished to arrive at Senegal as soon as possible to start his work, and was pressing Chaumaret to make haste. While the men were ashore purchasing provisions, the Echo arrived at Santa Cruz Bay, and its captain, François-Marie de Venancourt, boarded the Medusa. Venancourt was himself a monarchist, but unlike Chaumaret, he was an experienced and skilled navigator. Venancourt was disgusted by Chaumaret's trust and reliance on the braggart Richefort. Nevertheless, Richefort was essentially serving as captain, and he insisted it was too dangerous to remain anchored in the bay. He barked orders to the crew to once again tack back and forth, senselessly, in and out of danger. Charlotte Picard wrote of this, saying, Richefort gave these orders, quote, for no other reason than to show that he knew how to make the necessary maneuvers to tack. Every moment, we came, we went, we came back again. We drew near to reefs in order to defy them. All this went on so long that after a while the sailors refused to obey the scheming pilot, saying loudly that he was nothing but a vile impostor. These antics by Richefort prompted more complaints from officers, but Chaumaret would hear none of it, and denounced their complaints as mutiny. Miss Picard, taking note of Chaumaret's unease as a commander, wrote that he, quote, was without a doubt relieved to have someone else doing his job. Despite the protests, the captain once again ordered all crew to obey Richefort. The Medusa and Echo got underway once again for Senegal, sailing south-southwest. Many on board began to complain of headaches, which was no doubt from the blistering sun almost directly overhead as they moved through the tropics. Crossing the Tropic of Cancer brought a bit of much-needed levity, as the crew performed a light-hearted and customary ritual, prompting Chaumaret to permit a day of festivities for the following day. As was the custom, anyone crossing the tropic for the first time must pay a toll to the Lord of the Tropic. Sailors dressed as priests ceremoniously dunked all first-timers in the baptismal vat, going easier on the passengers. Just as the ritual was ending, buckets of water from high up in the mast rained down on everyone, causing a jovial uproar. Even during the frolicking ritual, Richefort self-importantly marched back and forth on the deck. He had the Medusa following the coast of Western Africa, with Chaumaret's approval, as this was the most direct route to Senegal. Sailing from France to Senegal was, and still is, extremely treacherous. More experienced navigators did not follow this course, instead choosing a more westerly course, away from the many dangerous reefs and shoals. Before departing France, Chaumaret was given advice from the French Naval Ministry to seek out more experienced navigators and learn from them. But Chaumaret would not stoop to fraternizing with Republicans and revolutionaries, and haughtily refused any advice from them. The ministry provided Chaumaret with maps and charts, such as they were, and a book from the French Cartography Office warning, it would be extremely dangerous to trust the available maps. The situation called for an experienced navigator, which Chamaret was not, and Richefort only imagined himself. Richefort had already put the Medusa in danger of running aground on two occasions, and now he was taking the Medusa on a dangerous course down the African coast. He constantly boasted of his knowledge of this coast, and, according to him, if not for his skill, the ship would have wrecked several times already. Savigny and Coriard described the Medusa as being less than half a cannon shot from land. In fact, the Medusa was already sailing in waters known, at least to experienced sailors, to contain many shallow hidden rocks. 30 known shipwrecks had occurred in these waters in the prior 25 years, with many of the poor souls on board being taken as slaves by the Moors, who occupied those lands. Officer of the watch, Ensign Maudet, knew of the danger ahead and suddenly changed the Medusa's course without consulting the captain. Some colorful words were exchanged between the captain and Maudet, but the ensign saved the Medusa from certain ruin. Chamaret and Richefort's incompetence was on display for all to see. Just earlier that morning, Chamaret mistakenly identified Cape Barbas, hours before the ship actually reached the Cape, which was clearly recognized by more experienced sailors. Although the Loire and Argus had broken away from the convoy many days prior, the Echo and Medusa continued south-southwest, staying within sight of each other. At first, the Echo was off the Medusa's stern on the port side. Throughout the night of the 1st of July, Captain Venancourt continually lit two lanterns, signaling its position to the Medusa. But the Medusa failed to send any signals in return. Around midnight, the Echo overtook the faster frigate, or so it appeared. It would not have been possible for the slower Echo to overtake the Medusa. Venancourt was taking the Echo more to the west, to safer waters, while the Medusa was taking the faster but treacherous southerly course. The ships drifted farther and farther apart, but Venancourt continued sending signals into the morning of July 2nd, even sending up a flare. Still, he received no response from the Medusa. Henri Savigny happened to be on the deck of the Medusa throughout the night as the Echo slowly pulled away. Savigny was witness to the lack of communication on board when the officer of the watch, Ensign Chaudier, failed to notify the captain when contact with the Echo was first lost. At midnight, Lieutenant Reynaud took over the watch. When he later spotted a light from the Echo, Savigny was again baffled by a failure to communicate this news to the captain. Finally, at 3 a.m., contact with the Echo was lost for good. Of particular concern to the sailors was the Arguin Bank. This is a massive offshore sandbank under shallow waters and notorious for many shipwrecks. The sailors and officers were aware of the danger, but did not trust their captain or the impostor Richefort to take notice. The common navigation instruction for reaching Saint-Louis was to spot Cape Blanc and then sail 60 miles on a south-southwest course, followed by a south-southeast course right into Senegal. Navigating in this manner would avoid the Arguin Bank and keep ships safely away from danger. The officers and crew of the Medusa had no faith in their captain to follow this advice, and so they hatched a scheme to trick Chamaret into believing the Cape was farther off to the south. If they could dupe him, he would take the Medusa further south-southwest and away from the Arguin Bank. A number of officers woke the captain from his sleep, pointing to what they were claiming was Cape Blanc. Ironically, Chamaret had believed he already spotted Cape Blanc earlier that day, just as he did with Cape Barbas. Despite this, the men easily convinced the captain to believe a large white cloud in the distance was Cape Blanc. Any sailor worth his salt could tell the difference between a cloud and a landmass, but Chamaret fell for their ruse. While they fooled the captain, Richefort's arrogance put a wrinkle into their plans. He refused to follow the conventional route of 60 miles to the south-southwest, and instead turned to the east after just 30 miles. By this time of the voyage, Chamaret had completely lost command of his vessel. His junior officers were purposely tricking him, and a civilian passenger had effectively taken over his command. When an officer dared to challenge Richefort, Chamaret had him arrested. Ensigns Laperere and Maudet echoed this concern to Richefort about the Arguin Bank, but Richefort quickly dismissed them, replying, "Never mind, we are in 80 fathoms." Infantry Captain Charles Picard had spent 2 years in Senegal previously, and he had traveled this route before. When he too voiced his concerns to Richefort, he was told firmly, "We know our job. Get on with yours and rest calm." At this time, the Medusa was safely in deeper water. That evening, a sounding revealed 120 fathoms, or about 220 meters, and Picard tried to rest and get some sleep.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually, right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
By morning, conditions had noticeably changed. Even civilian passengers noticed the change in the water color from a deep blue to light green, and schools of fish could be seen, indicating shallower water. Another indication was the large quantity of kelp they were seeing on the surface of the water. Concern grew among virtually everyone on board, except Jean Marais and Richefort. By midday of July 3rd, the water had become quite clear, indicating extremely shallow water. Ensign Maudet and Midshipman Rang took over their shift on the watch at noon, and they were convinced the ship was doomed. They knew they were heading straight for the Arguin Bank, and also that Chamaret and Richefort would not change course. The water had become so shallow that sand was being churned up in the water and was clearly visible to observers on the ship. Still, they continued on. Water temperatures had been regularly taken during the voyage, and it was discovered the water had increased in temperature by 4 degrees over the last 4 hours. This was, again, an indication of shallow water. A sounding proved they were in just 18 fathoms of water now. Finally, Chamaret gave the order to steer a bit more to the west. The tension on board was palpable, as almost everyone fell silent, awaiting their fate. When another sounding was taken, it revealed just 10 fathoms, then 6 fathoms. Just then, a scraping, grinding sound could be heard, and the ship horrifyingly shuddered and slowed. Sailors and passengers alike were stricken with terror. They were, as they feared, running aground in a most inhospitable place. The Medusa's keel scraped across the rocks below one final time, and after a big forward lurch, came to a sudden halt, stuck fast on the sand of the Arguin Bank. Chaos erupted, with officers shouting orders to get the ship refloated. Passengers shrieked and cried in horror, some voicing their displeasure with the captain and Richefort. All the pent-up frustrations and politically motivated angst began to erupt. Captain Chamaret sat in stunned silence. He had given away his command to an incompetent fool and allowed this man to wreck his ship. Ensign Laperere rushed to Richefort, shouting, "You see, sir, to what your obstinacy has brought us. I had warned you of it." Throughout the remainder of the day, a confusion of activity took place on board. As different groups of men and officers failed to coordinate with each other, all efforts to get the ship afloat were ineffective, and emotions were running high. Fearing the worst, some attention was given to the ship's longboat, which was in desperate need of repair. After assessing its condition, the boat was recocked and sealed to prepare it to take on passengers. Running aground was not uncommon, and experienced sailors had the knowledge and skills to often refloat their ships. The officers were hopeful the Medusa was grounded at low tide, and that high tide would free them. But they had been grounded at high tide, and the ocean would not raise their ship any higher than it already was. The crew placed a kedge anchor into the longboat and then dropped it a distance away from the ship. A kedge anchor is used to help pull a ship into deeper water in situations just like this. But the kedge anchor did not help pull the ship free. Another attempt was made farther away from the ship, but the anchor wouldn't hold, and the Medusa remained where she was. The heavier bower anchor was also on board, but only the governor's barge could carry its massive weight. This barge, however, was in disrepair and required time to caulk, seal, and reinforce it, and empty barrels were attached to provide it with greater buoyancy. When the bower anchor was finally dropped, the water was so shallow that it did not fully submerge. The effort was fruitless. To prevent the ship from further listing over, the ship's top masts were dismantled and thrown into the sea. In such situations, it was common to push the heavy guns into the sea to lighten the ship significantly. Chaumareuil absolutely would not allow this, claiming the ship would be defenseless, and he would not abandon the king's property. By nightfall, activity ceased, and everyone settled in to try and get some rest. By morning of July 3rd, it became clear that they would have to abandon the ship and seek the shore of Africa on the ship's boats. Richefort had by now been ridiculed and disgraced by the crew, and he mostly kept quiet. Chaumareuil was still in a stupor and utterly useless. Governor Schmaltz filled the power void and began taking control of the situation. Schmaltz was a man of changing loyalties, and throughout his career tended to side with whomever gave him an advantage. He was perhaps not a loyal monarchist or a staunch Republican, but he did wish to survive. Schmaltz arranged for a ship's council, and ideas were presented for the evacuation of all crew and passengers. The ship's boats were not in good condition, but it was suggested to ferry the passengers and crew to the coast, making multiple trips. Once on shore, they would walk to the settlement of Saint-Louis, and hopefully have safety in numbers. Others thought the most seaworthy boats should be sent to Senegal to get help. Ultimately, it was the plan from Governor Schmaltz that was accepted. This plan was to put as many people into the boats as possible, and to build a large raft out of planks and other bits of the Medusa. Chaumareuil supported the idea, and construction of the raft began immediately. During the night of July 3rd and into the morning of July 4th, a group of angry and no doubt frightened soldiers and sailors broke into the wine and liquor on board. A drunken spree ensued, as the men broke into trunks, put on fine clothes of the gentlemen on board, and even ransacked the captain's own supply of wine. Others on board fearfully watched and listened to the band of unruly men break into the provisions of food and wine, causing everyone else to grab what they could out of fear of starving. When daylight broke on July 4th, ensigns La Perrière and Maudet wished to make another effort to refloat the ship using the kedge anchor. Before doing so, they asked permission to lighten the weight of the ship again by dumping all unnecessary items overboard. Governor Schmaltz did not allow them to do so, fearing the loss of their food and valuables. The attempt to refloat the Medusa was not successful, and a depressing anxiousness settled over the ship. Of these efforts, Coriard and Savigny wrote, "Only half measures were adopted, and in all the maneuvers, great want of decision prevailed." Construction of the raft continued nonstop under the leadership of Lieutenant Espiot. The raft was a crude crisscross of different lengths of planks and logs, and whatever could be salvaged from the Medusa. A small raised deck was built in the middle of the raft to serve as a quarterdeck of sorts. The bow and stern of the raft were flimsy and not strong enough to support the weight of any passengers, and the railings were only 15 inches high. The raft was built quickly and fell far short of being anything remotely seaworthy. Schmaltz made a promise to all on board that the raft would be towed by the five largest of the ship's boats, and they would all travel together on foot to Senegal. Next came the difficult decision of deciding who would be placed in the boats and who would be relegated to the raft. An infantry lieutenant, Anglas de Praville, later wrote of this, claiming Schmaltz and Chaumareuil had already established places for themselves on the largest and safest boats. All of the naval officers and most of the sailors were assigned to the boats, while the soldiers and their officers were assigned to the raft, along with a handful of sailors and other passengers. Charles Picard was furious when he discovered that he and his family, who were traveling with him, were to board the raft with the drunken soldiers who were already pillaging everything they could get their hands on. Eventually, Schmaltz gave in and promised Picard they could be placed in one of the boats. During the night of July 4th, the weather worsened and the seas became violent, ending a relatively calm night of rest for those on the Medusa. The waves bashed the hull of the ship in steady jolts. The ship groaned and creaked as its hull struggled to withstand the pounding. Soldiers of the Africa Battalion on board became suspicious of being abandoned in the middle of the night by the sailors, and they gathered on the deck. They stood guard and threatened to shoot anyone who tried to escape on one of the boats. Governor Schmaltz had to intervene and finally calm the soldiers. He repeated to all again that nobody on board was going to be left behind on the Medusa. They would travel together, roughly 400 in all the way to Senegal. Later that evening, the raft broke loose from the ship. Sailors wearing as many as 5 life jackets jumped into the sea to haul the raft back and secure it to the Medusa. By 3 o'clock a.m. on the 5th of July, the Medusa began to break apart and was taking on water. In an almost comical frenzy, soldiers and sailors wearing the fine clothes of officers and even ladies began hoarding anything of value they could find. Candlesticks, plates, and other items that would serve no use during their struggle to survive. By 5 a.m., the Medusa had reached a critical point and was deteriorating quickly. Governor Schmaltz had no choice but to order the evacuation of the ship into the boats and the raft. He had carefully planned this evacuation, with a list of who would embark in each boat, who would be on the raft, and the amount of provisions to be loaded in each boat. But as chaos and panic swept over the ship, barrels of supplies were carelessly tossed into the sea. Soldiers pushed their way to the raft first. Infantry officers supervised the soldiers and refused to allow them to bring any looted items or their weapons onto the raft. Charlotte Picard wrote of this, saying, "Whose brain seemed severely affected, mounted on the bulwarks as if on a horse, and, armed with 2 pistols, threatened to shoot anybody who hesitated to descend." After just 40 soldiers had boarded the raft, the men were standing in knee-deep water. The hastily built raft was already struggling to stay afloat under the weight. In a panic, barrels of much-needed supplies were rolled overboard to lighten the raft. With over 100 people still to board, it became clear that the raft would remain partially submerged, providing for quite a miserable experience. Only 2 tubs of wine and 2 containers of water were left for the 147 people who embarked on the raft. When a 25-pound bag of flour was thrown to them from the Medusa, it landed in the water. Although quickly retrieved, it was now a disgusting paste of flour and salt water. Those on the raft were crammed into every inch of space available. Coriart shouted to Lieutenant Reynaud on the Medusa, asking, "Are we in a condition to depart? Have we instruments and charts?" Reynaud assured him, everything they needed was on the raft. "What naval officer was to come and command us?" asked Coriart. "It is I. In a moment, I shall be with you," replied Reynaud. Immediately following this short conversation, Reynaud scurried off and boarded the governor's barge. Describing this treachery, Coriart and Sevigny wrote, "How is it possible that a French sea officer should be guilty of such bad faith to his unhappy countrymen, who placed all their confidence in him?" Charlotte Picard looked on from the deck of the Medusa as the governor's wife and daughter were lowered into the barge, and then finally the governor himself was lowered down in a chair. Others of Schmaltz's close circle were placed on the more comfortable barge, which also carried a hefty share of the supplies. The barge meant for 50 people was carrying just 36, and easily could have taken on more. When a group of sailors who had fallen into the ocean attempted to put themselves on the barge, the governor's armed guard fought them off with his sword. Charles Picard and his family stood on the deck of the Medusa as they watched the governor's barge and other boats sail off. The governor's barge circled the Medusa, and for a moment, the family believed it was coming back to allow them to board. But their hopes were dashed when the barge continued on, with Chamaret callously saying the family would be too much of a burden. Fearing for his family's safety, Picard shouted for Ensign Laperriere, who had previously promised to take the family on the scout ship which he would command. But Laperriere sailed away, with no intention of returning. When a small skiff pulled alongside the Medusa, Picard begged the sailors to allow his family to board. When his request was denied, Picard grabbed a rifle and threatened to start shooting if his family wasn't permitted to board. Finally, Picard and his 8 family members entered the skiff, but the sailors made them toss all their possessions into the sea. Captain Chaumareys stood helpless aboard the Medusa while the boats and raft were loaded. Just before the last of the boats pulled away, Chaumareys boarded a barge, abandoning his ship while 64 remained on board the Medusa. As Chaumareys departed, one of the men exclaimed, "Since you are leaving us, at least give us the pleasure, if you reach France, of giving our families the news." The captain's barge pulled away, and Midshipman Rang called back to the Medusa, promising to return for them. Among those abandoned on the Medusa was Anglas de Praviel, who became frantic and despondent, threatening to end his own life. Another infantryman, filled with rage at those who betrayed them, raised his rifle to take a shot at Chaumareys, but his aim was thwarted by a man named Rabaroust, who was incidentally a stowaway on the Medusa. Chaumareys got away safely on his barge, commanded by Midshipman Rang, followed by Ensign Maudet in the Senegal boat, Ensign Laperriere in the scout boat, and the governor's barge, commanded by Lieutenant Reynaud, was at the rear. The 4 boats were tied together, and tow ropes from each were connected to the overcrowded and half-submerged raft. Shouts of "Vive le roi!" "Long live the king!" came from the raft, and a small white Bourbon flag on the end of a musket was hoisted from its small raised deck. The ship's longboat was commanded by Lieutenant Espio, and was in too delicate of a condition to help tow the raft. Before boarding his barge, Chaumareys ordered Espio to return to the frigate and take the 20 or so men left on board. To the surprise of Espio, he saw over 60 frantic men still on board the frigate, and took all but 17 of them into the longboat. The men who remained on the Medusa were either too frightened to leave the relative safety of the frigate, or were too drunk and disorderly to do so. Espio swore that a boat would be sent for them as soon as they reached Senegal. The rickety longboat was now overcrowded and lying very low in the water. Any slight tipping of the boat caused water to pour over its sides. Espio's plan was to pull alongside the other boats, which were not overburdened, and offload some of the passengers. But this proved to be more difficult than he expected. As he approached the governor's barge, he was quickly rebuked. Governor Schmaltz himself refused to take anyone on board, claiming he had already taken too many. Ensign Laperriere also refused to allow anyone additional on board. Espio was callously told that it was his own burden to take care for these people whom he rescued. Espio then guided his vessel to the other boats, pleading to offload some of his passengers, but was roundly refused. Making matters worse, those on the boats were fearful of being sunk by the unstable longboat. Espio approached the Senegal boat, coming dangerously close to colliding with it. Ensign Maudet broke the tow rope and detached his boat from the captain's barge in order to maneuver out of the way. Maudet immediately asked Captain Chaumareys to take the tow rope and tie it up again, which he agreed to do. But Maudet's actions caused a domino effect of panic, believing Maudet was cutting himself free to head for the shore. Lieutenant Reynaud on the governor's barge suddenly began hacking away at the rope towing the raft. Chaumareys called out, "What are you doing?" Reynaud deviously replied, "The tow rope was not let go from my boat, but from that behind me." Chaumareys ordered him to regain hold of the rope. But Reynaud answered, "We forsake them." Incredulous, Chaumareys exclaimed, "We didn't hear you." The response was repeated, "We forsake them." Men on the longboat, seeing this cruelty unfold, took aim to fire on the governor's barge, but Lieutenant Espio defused the situation. Those on the raft watched in horror as Reynaud, then the others, cut away their tow ropes. They cried out, "They are abandoning us," and panic overcame them. More chants of "Long live the king! Long live France!" erupted from the raft, desperate to be heard and for the boats to return. With the raft cut loose and the other boats unencumbered, Ensign Laperriere began sailing the governor's barge east toward shore, and the other boats followed suit. Captain Chaumareys cheerfully waved his cap as his barge sailed away from the raft. 147 souls were abandoned and left to die. That is going to do it for part one of The Raft of the Medusa. Please make sure to listen to part two, as we discover the fate of those on the raft, in the ship's boats, and those abandoned on the Medusa. You won't want to miss it. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can follow the show on social media and YouTube at ShipwrecksPod. You can find show notes, images, and transcripts at shipwrecksandseadogs.com. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs merchandise is also available, so go ahead, buy a shirt for yourself, and help the show at the same time. Want to hear Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs without ads? Subscribe to the Into History podcast channel for ad-free episodes, bonus content, a private community, and more. You'll get access to all the great podcasts of Into History, including History Daily, History That Doesn't Suck, Her Half of History, and many, many more. Subscribe today at intohistory.com/shipwreckspod. Original theme music is by the amazing wizard, Sean Siegfried. You can follow him on YouTube at Sean Secret or on the web at seansiegfried.com. Please join me next time, but until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.